tactics. It is best to confront mistakes honestly while not using them as opportunities for condemnation. To many, passive-aggressive approaches or manipulative encounters with leaders diminish their view of that particular leader and make them cynical about their contribution to the task at hand or even the organization they serve. It is to your advantage to pull people out of their dejected state as quickly as possible. Do so by calling out their mistakes quietly and returning them to a place of confidence and strength. Chapter 4. Ask questions instead of giving direct orders. In the military, orders are part of everyday operations. You receive orders, and you are expected to follow them to a T. But when Captain D. Michael Abrashoff took command of the USS Benfold, a guided missile destroyer, he knew he was facing a challenge that would require a different approach. The Benfold was not the top ship in the Navy, not by far. The crew was sullen, morale was low, and most of the sailors on the ship were just biding their time until their discharge date. To add complexity to an already difficult leadership situation, the previous commander had not been well-loved, so the crew was assessing their new leader with a harsh and critical eye. But this was Captain Abrashoff's first sea command, and he was determined to do it well. His first step? Learn about his crew. It didn't take me long to realize that my young crew was smart, talented, and full of good ideas that frequently came to nothing because no one in charge had ever listened to them, wrote Captain Abrashoff in It's Your Ship, his leadership chronicles of his time aboard the Benfold. So Captain Abrashoff vowed to listen to his crew, but not just when they decided to speak up. He knew that if he wanted to turn the ship around, the ideas for how to do that had to come from the crew. And what better way to find out what their ideas were than to interview them? Captain Abrashoff interviewed 5 crew members a day until he had interviewed every crew member on board, approximately 310 of them. What did he learn? That they wasted a lot of time on dreary chores, such as painting the ship 6 times a year. So Abrashoff found a way to replace all of the fasteners on the ship that caused rust streaks and a way to run many of the exterior panels through a special paint process. The ship didn't have to be painted again for almost 2 years, freeing up time for more valuable endeavors, such as advanced training. He learned that many of them had signed up for the Navy as a way to pay for college, so he arranged for SAT testing on the ship and long-distance advanced placement courses for the crew. He found that many of them came from rough backgrounds and had led tough lives, but also were very attached to their families. So he included family members as much as possible in the sailors' lives by sending birthday cards, letters of praise, and other important notes to parents and spouses. "I wanted to link our goals," wrote Captain Abrashoff, "so that they would see my priority of improving Benfold as an opportunity for them to apply their talents and give their jobs a real purpose." What was the result of asking questions of his crew? A serious shift in morale, a greater willingness to push the limits of what was possible, and some of the highest test rankings the Navy had ever seen. If Captain Abrashoff had stepped on board, issued a directive that the crew was to improve its rankings, and then outlined how that would happen, what might the result have been? We'll never know, but it is unlikely that the Benfold would have become the ship or the leadership catalyst it became. Asking questions not only makes an order more palatable and reduces resentment, it often stimulates creativity and innovation in solving the problem at hand. People are more likely to follow a new path if they feel that they have been involved in shaping it. The familial leaders of the Marriott organization were known for their intense devotion to inspecting Marriott hotels to ensure that they were well run. Bill Marriott Jr., in particular, was constantly on the go, asking questions and paying close attention to the responses, writes Ed Fuller, the leader of Marriott International Lodging. "In fact," he continues, "sometimes he would be criticized for listening to too many people and listening just as hard to frontline people as to senior executives. His favorite question during his frontline visitations was, "What do you think?" It was his way of combating the tendency of employees to shy away from rocking the boat or passing on bad news to the boss. Bill Marriott Jr. was an enlightened leader who understood the negative power of the mum effect and how best to engage employees in making every Marriott property live up to his expectations. While we understand that asking questions increases the engagement of those we hope to influence, many leaders don't take this route. Why? Because at times, asking questions can seem like a roundabout way to lead people to the answer you already have in your head. Why not just tell them? It would be more expedient. People don't like to be ordered around. That's why. Leaders are also reluctant to ask questions because they don't know what responses might result. What if the other person doesn't head in the direction you were intending? There's no way to overcome that possibility. Instead, leaders must think about it as an opportunity rather than as a risk. The answer you get may be better, likely will be better, than the one you already know. When Ian McDonald of Johannesburg, South Africa, the general manager of a small manufacturing plant specializing in precision machine parts, had the opportunity to accept a very large order, he was convinced that he could not meet the promised delivery date. The work already scheduled in the shop and the short completion time needed for this order made it seem impossible for him to accept the order. Instead of pushing his people to accelerate their work and rush the order through, he called everybody together, explained the situation to them, and told them how much it would mean to the company and to them if they could make it possible to produce the order on time. Then he started asking questions. Is there anything we can do to handle this order? Can anyone think of different ways to process it through the shop that will make it possible to take the order? Is there any way to adjust our hours or personnel assignments that would help? The employees came up with many ideas and insisted that he take the order. The order was accepted, produced, and delivered on time. While it should not be the case, many leaders dread doing performance reviews. They know they have employees who need improvement, and they foresee a battle as they deliver criticism and the employees become increasingly defensive and sullen. These leaders need to take a different tack. Most employees have a keen understanding of their own strengths and weaknesses. While some may be obtuse, most, if you ask, will tell you exactly what you are thinking. Many organizational psychologists recommend instituting a self-appraisal stage in the review process. Studies have shown that self-appraisals lead to reviews that are more satisfying for managers and employees and have a greater positive effect on performance. Begin by giving the employee some questions to think about prior to the review. What do you think you're exceptionally good at? What are your goals for the coming year? Where do you think you could improve your skills or abilities to help you meet those goals? Imagine beginning the meeting with a complete set of answers to these questions, answers that you don't have to deliver. At least 80% of the time, they will have come to the same conclusions you've arrived at, and the conversation will be a much more positive one. The wonderful thing about asking questions is that it can be effectively done in almost any medium. What if you sent a text or tweet to your team with a question about how to handle a recalcitrant client? Would that help employees who might be weak in this area reconsider their own methods or recognize that they don't have one? You can ask pretty powerful questions in 140 characters or less. Questions allow you to create a conversation in any medium that can lead to a better place for all involved. And it allows everybody to feel that they were involved in shaping the outcome. Wouldn't you rather be asked a question than be given an order? Chapter 5. Mitigate Fault. In the summer of 1941, Sergeant James Allen Ward was awarded the Victoria Cross for climbing out onto the wing of his Wellington bomber, 13,000 feet above Zuider Zee, to extinguish a fire in the starboard engine. Secured by only a rope around his waist, he managed to smother the fire and then return along the wing to the safety of the aircraft's cabin. Winston Churchill, an admirer as well as a performer of swashbuckling exploits, summoned the shy New Zealander to 10 Downing Street. Ward, struck dumb with awe in Churchill's presence, was unable to answer the Prime Minister's questions. Churchill surveyed the unhappy hero with some compassion. "You must feel very humble and awkward in my presence," he said. "Yes, sir," managed Ward. "Then you can imagine how humble and awkward I feel in yours," said Churchill. With just a few words, Churchill moved Ward from a miserable fool to the hero he was. He mitigated fault and helped Ward save face. Few of us take the time to consider how to let another save face. We ride roughshod over others' feelings, getting our own way, finding fault, issuing threats, criticizing a child or employee in front of others. We could offer a considerate word or two, take the other person's feelings into account, pull them aside, anything, to alleviate the sting. Yet many of us don't take the time to do so. For leaders, what does this insensitive behavior instill in those around us? Fear of failure. If we know we will be berated for our failures, possibly even publicly, will we take any risks in our work? Will we attempt to be innovative or creative? Will we speak up with ideas and opinions? Probably not. Yet failure is an everyday part of our lives, at home, at work, in all of our endeavors. It is such a given that the venerable Harvard Business Review devoted its entire April 2011 issue to the subject. The cover heading and tagline? The Failure Issue. How to understand it, learn from it, and recover from it. Not one mention of avoiding it. Of course, we intuitively know that failure is inevitable, so why can't we be more supportive when somebody is suffering through it? An executive at a large media company was responsible for launching a new magazine. She spent a year's worth of time, effort, and resources trying to get the fledgling publication off the ground, but it never flew. The magazine had to be canceled. The CEO of the company, who could have fired or demoted the executive for the failure, or who could have held her up as an example of what not to do, instead provided a psychological safety net, allowing the executive to save face. The CEO stood up at a gathering of the firm's top executives and congratulated the failed executive for her courage and skill, for doing the wrong thing in the right way. He emphasized that the ill-fated decision wasn't just hers. Senior management backed it, and the magazine failed despite great content and marketing, writes Robert Sutton in Good Boss, Bad Boss. What this CEO epitomized in his actions was a technique that Sutton calls forgive and remember, a critical path for learning from mistakes and changing behavior. The technique was first described by Charles L. Bosk in his book Forgive and Remember, Managing Medical Failure. The goal is to help individuals achieve accountability while managing the existential problem of failure, a demoralizing inner battle for anyone. Isn't this the true responsibility of any leader? Because if the battle is lost, the individual will learn little from the mistake, have a diminished self-image, become fearful, and contribute less to the success of a company, a family, or any other organization. Despite a leader's best efforts, those in his care will fail, and he will fail. Recognizing this and the inherent benefits failure may present can help us learn how to help others come through it and land positively and securely on the opposite shore. Great leaders tap the creative and innovative power of their teams by helping them save face before they've even failed. Fiona Lee, Amy Edmondson, and Stefan Tomke conducted a study with 688 employees in a large healthcare organization during the rollout of a new data system that integrated and presented data from all departments and divisions within the organization. The employees received little training and were told to learn the system by experimenting with it. The findings? In departments where managers specifically told their teams that making mistakes was okay and didn't set up reward systems that penalized people who did make mistakes, experimentation with the system was much greater. In departments where managers were inconsistent in their messages or punished failure, even subtly, employees experimented with the system much less. In fact, lower status employees in those departments didn't use the system at all because of their greater fear of failure. As you might expect, the employees who experimented the most with the new, more efficient system became the most proficient with it and used it regularly in their everyday work. What the supportive managers were actually developing within their team members, even if only on a small scale, was resilience. Resilience, explains Martin P. Seligman, author and positive psychology pioneer, is the difference in the ways people respond to failure. In his books and other writings, he describes how some people bounce back from failure, learning and growing from the experience, while others languish, becoming self-critical and fearful of the future. Which would you rather foster in the people in your life? Companies who recruit from the military have learned the value of resilience well. They recognize that people in the military are used to dealing with mistakes and failures, sometimes on an almost moment-by-moment basis, and moving forward purposefully despite them. Donovan Campbell, author of Joker 1, a memoir about his experience as a platoon leader in Iraq, is part of PepsiCo's Elite Leadership Development Program. He explains the perspective he gained while commanding a platoon. In school, you're rewarded for not making mistakes, and then you get out and get a job, and a lot of times you get promoted because you make very few mistakes. And so what you do is you develop a mindset that mistakes are to be avoided at all costs. What you learn in the military is that it doesn't matter how hard you try or how good you are. One, you will make mistakes. And two, sometimes events or the enemy or a changing situation will mean that you do not succeed. And in fact, you fail and you become comfortable with the idea. This mature approach to failure, as opposed to being frozen in a state of indecisiveness or inaction, is what we want from our employees and our leaders. Making it safe for them to fail is a sure way to ensure that they will more readily admit their mistakes, which is a key aspect of leadership we've explored, more quickly recover from them, more fully learn from them. As a leader, you will gain a more complete picture of their work and become a better coach and mentor for it. So how do we create this type of environment? Charlene Lee, in her important book, Open Leadership, maps out 5 actions that leaders can take to instill organizational resilience within their teams. Acknowledge that failure happens. Leaders can acknowledge failures quickly when they happen, but they can also discuss with their teams the likelihood of failures occurring. Encourage dialogue to foster trust. Honestly discussing problems is the best way to learn from them and to trim the seedlings before they become fully grown catastrophes. Separate the person from the failure. Rather than saying, you failed, say, the project failed. In most cases, that is the truth. Amy Edmondson, Harvard professor and researcher, explored this point with executives. When I ask executives to estimate how many of the failures in their organizations are truly blameworthy, their answers are usually in single digits, perhaps 2% to 5%. But when I ask how many are treated as blameworthy, they say, after a pause or a laugh, 70% to 90%. The unfortunate consequence is that many failures go unreported and their lessons are lost. Learn from your mistakes. Otherwise, they are lost opportunities for learning and for coaching. Create a risk-taking and failure system. Being methodical about how we approach risk and failure can help mitigate some of the emotional responses to it. Why go to these lengths? Alberto Alessi, the great Italian designer, described his company's approach to design as an effort to find the borderline between what is possible and what is not possible and design along it. The best designs are those that fall right on the edge of the borderline, just this side of possible. That is the space of innovation, the space where we test our talents and grow as individuals. Of course, Hugging the line means that you will often flop over it. You will fall into the realm of the impossible and fail. But what a glorious failure it will be, and who knows what might be learned from it. Famed vacuum cleaner designer Sir Richard Dyson produced more than 5,000 prototypes before bringing his first product to market. What we must remember when faced with a person who has made a mistake is that how he handles it is dependent on the support he receives while living through the tough moment and learning from it. A primary difference between ordinary and extraordinary people is how they perceive and respond to failure. A good leader can influence which camp we fall into. Now, there are mistakes, and then there are mistakes. Some mistakes come about from minor lapses in judgment, from inexperience, from the need for coaching. These are actual mistakes. Others come about from recklessness, greed, a lack of concern for others' well-being, and a desire to elevate oneself at the expense of others. In these instances, it's highly likely that the person at fault actually feels no remorse, no sense of accountability. Is it appropriate to help such an individual save face? Possibly not. If the mistake and attitude are severe enough, it's likely that helping the other person save face would just exacerbate the problem. In these instances, it's best to keep public comments to a minimum and use private conversations to address the severity of the issue as deftly as possible. Other than creating an environment in which people are not pilloried for their mistakes when part of a larger whole, Charlene Lee's advice can be transferred to situations when we should help an individual save face to recover from a minor error, oversight, or gaffe. Acknowledge that a mistake was made, but do it gently. Pretending that nothing happened certainly meets the forgive criteria, but it seems a little disingenuous when the error was blatant. Recognize and address your own role, even if minor. Focus on what was gained. When appropriate to do so, without making others culpable, address the issue from a broad perspective. Imagine that you are at a function and are introduced to somebody you've met before, but he clearly doesn't remember you. You could say, "We've met before," throwing his error in his face. Or you could say, "Oh, hello, Mark. It's nice to see you again. Did I see you at the Better Business Bureau lunch last month? It was a great networking event. Although there were so many people, it was a bit overwhelming." Today, our faults, missteps, and outright failures are so much more public than they once were. When an employee makes a mistake, it's not surprising when a customer starts blogging about it, posts the experience on her Facebook page, or shoots off a quick email tirade to the CEO of the company. The employee is already in a position to feel humiliated and fearful. Why make it worse? Allowing others to save face is crucial in the digital age. Of course, helping someone save face is sometimes more difficult to do because his failures have been broadcast. It is important to maintain strict discipline in terms of what you write in emails. An email accidentally sent to the wrong person or hacked and posted on a blog may not only cause embarrassment, but also ruin somebody's professional reputation. If you need to discuss a mistake or gaffe that somebody made, it's best to do it in person or over the phone. Save your written communication for praise and constructive advice. While it's important to help others weather their failures gracefully, helping a customer or a potential customer save face can be useful as a business tactic. Wolfgang Schmidt explained how his company, Rubbermaid, uses the technique to win new customers. "We do get complaints. About half those complaints come about as a result of a consumer buying a product, thinking it's ours, but it's a competitor's product. So the consumer writes to us. Our policy is simply to write a personal letter and say, 'We can understand how you made the mistake because we have these competitors who copy our products. You made an honest mistake, but we would like for you to see directly the difference in value. So try one of ours for free.' We send them our replacement product for whatever it is they complained about. And we think that's a wonderful way to communicate very credibly the story of Rubbermaid value." Even if the other person is wrong, We only destroy ego by causing someone to lose face. We do nothing to change his or her behavior. On the other hand, when we mitigate fault, we not only save the other person's psyche, we build confidence and trust into our relationship with that person. Save someone's face once, and your influence with him rises. Save his face every time you can, and there is practically nothing he won't do for you. Chapter 6. Magnify Improvement. One bright day in 2010, the hotel company Best Western created a special Facebook page. Visitors flocked to it. Hundreds of messages were posted to the wall. Wallace makes weary travelers feel like they're coming home. The best thing about the hotel lobby is his smile. Wallace is the best. We love going back just to visit with him. Upon leaving, the kids asked when we were coming back to see Wallace. I may pass him in the lobby or the hall 15 times in a visit, and every time he has a great big smile and something fun to say. He is one of the greatest parts of my visits. We should all relate to one another as Wallace does. If he ever has a bad day, you wouldn't know it. In all of my travels, I've never encountered anyone more kind and helpful, more eager to make a guest feel welcome. My day is always made brighter by seeing Wallace. His warm welcome, his knowledge of the city, his kindness and professionalism, and that terrific smile make my stay so enjoyable. He has a special gift for connecting with people. Who is this Wallace? Wallace Pope, Chicago native, single dad, longtime employee of Best Western River North Hotel, and a man who loves helping others. When Wallace was nominated for the Stars of the Industry Award from the Illinois Hotel and Lodging Association, Best Western was determined to show its pride and support, and to help him win. So the company created a Facebook page called Wallace Should Win, and encouraged visitors to the hotel to go to the page and share their stories of Wallace's customer service skills. The page had 2,722 visits within the first week. Heartfelt stories of love and support poured in from the hotel's customers. Wallace's genuine kindness and his ability to improve customers' travel and personal outlook were lauded again and again. And while Wallace didn't win the award, the praise and encouragement he gained from the Facebook page was far more meaningful than a plaque. Praise and encouragement, the two essential elements of motivating any person to fulfill their potential, to improve, or to tackle change. Yet it's difficult for many of us to recognize the efforts of those around us. Dr. Gerald Graham was curious about what managers could do to better motivate employees. So he surveyed 1,500 employees, and the results were rather shocking. 58% reported that they seldom, if ever, received praise from their manager. 76% reported that they seldom, if ever, received written thanks. 81% reported that they seldom, if ever, received praise in public. And yet, praise from a manager, written thanks, and public praise were three of the top five motivators among the surveyed employees. These results were from 1982. Decades later, things haven't changed all that much. Employees who receive frequent praise are still more productive, and organizations in which employees receive frequent praise are universally more successful. It's one of the 12 indicators of success that Marcus Buckingham and Kurt Kaufman outline in First, Break All the Rules, indicators based on extensive Gallup organization research. Yet managers are still notoriously bad at delivering praise. We all crave appreciation. We all desire to feel important. And when we have improved in some way or performed well, receiving praise sends a clear message that others have noticed and that it makes a difference. This is true at work, at home, at school, in our communities. One of the basic psychological tenets of human behavior is that we persist in behaviors for which we are praised. Those behaviors that are not positively recognized are likely to fall by the wayside. The Center for Management and Organization Effectiveness offers the following advice for praising those around you. 1. Deliver praise from your heart. Be genuine and sincere. 2. Deliver praise as soon as possible. Don't wait for the next meeting, performance review, family meal, or church gathering. By then, the person's own joy at the success has dissipated, and you've lost an opportunity to amplify that joy. 3. Make praise specific. A simple thank you is not praise. It is politeness. To feel that their efforts are heading them down the path you want them to go, people need to know exactly what you valued in their effort. 4. Praise people publicly. In this era of social technology, praising publicly gets easier every day, so there's no real excuse not to do it. Best Western certainly did. Today, you don't have to wait for the next quarterly meeting to recognize a job well done. We should strive to praise as often as possible. Most of us don't have to struggle to find opportunities to do so. We simply have to take advantage of the opportunities that exist every day. Captain Abrashoff of the USS Benfold understood the power of praise better than most. He wrote, "Most of my young sailors came from hardscrabble backgrounds and had struggled to make it into the Navy. I put myself in their parents' shoes and imagined how they would feel if they got letters from their kid's commanding officer, and I imagined how the kids would feel when their parents told them. I began writing letters to the parents, especially when their sons or daughters did something I could honestly praise. When the letters arrived, the parents invariably called their children to say how proud they were of them." One sailor was part of a team that had performed very well, but was himself not a star. Captain Abrashoff recognized that praising his accomplishments as part of a team would give this sailor the boost he most likely needed. So he sent a letter of praise to the young man's parents. 2 weeks later, the sailor knocked on Captain Abrashoff's door with tears streaming down his face. "I just got a call from my father, who all my life told me I'm a failure. This time, he said he's just read your letter and he wanted to congratulate me and say how proud he was of me. It's the first time in my entire life he's actually encouraged me." Obviously, this was a powerful moment for this young man. How do you think it affected his view of what he could achieve and his level of devotion to the success of his team? Praise, while powerful and necessary, also implies evaluation against some standard. What great leaders and those with influence recognize is that the rest of the time we must use encouragement. Praise is given only when one achieves good results. Encouragement can be given any time, even when things go poorly. That is the essence of encouragement, showing your belief in the talent, skills, and inherent abilities of another person because she exists, regardless of how things are going right now. Being encouraging requires a special attitude. When you look at another person, rather than seeing her faults, you need to be able to see her strengths and possibilities, what she is capable of. Insincere encouragement without the strength of your genuine faith in the other person only belittles her efforts. What does encouragement foster in the other person? Psychological hardiness, the ability to weather the stressful and anxiety-inducing challenges that we encounter every day, to face those challenges and move forward in spite of them, to pick ourselves up and keep going, keep trying. It is the hallmark of positive, successful people. Encouragement provides motivation, and finding ways to motivate is a huge struggle for leaders in all areas of life. The primary cause of that struggle? Many of us don't take the time to consider what actually motivates people. We often assume that people want material rewards, that the carrot and stick approach is the best approach, but this is rarely the case. People are genuinely more motivated by personal and social encouragement than by material rewards. Through his research on healthy marriages and families, author and psychologist John Carlson defined some essential practices that we can use to create an encouraging environment. 1. Make healthy relationships a priority. respect and positive communication are two key elements of making that happen. 2. Practice encouragement daily. Don't wait until somebody has stumbled on the path toward a goal. Recognize every effort and every improvement, even if it is slight, to let them know that your faith in them is unwavering. 3. Be inclusive. For instance, include others in your decision-making process whenever possible. It shows your faith in their sound judgment. 4. Don't let conflicts fester. When we're in conflict mode, it's easy to slip into discouraging or belittling dialogue. Compare, "I think you can do it," and "looks like we have a problem, what should we do about it," with "just let me take care of this," or "I told you to be careful." 5. Have fun. Clarence M. Jones, a Carnegie Institute instructor, told how encouragement and making faults seem easy to correct completely changed the life of his son. My son David, who was then 15 years old, came to live with me in Cincinnati. He had led a rough life. In 1958, his head was cut open in a car accident, leaving a very bad scar on his forehead. In 1960, his mother and I were divorced, and he moved to Dallas, Texas with his mother. He had spent most of his school years in special classes for slow learners. Possibly because of the scar, school administrators had decided he was brain injured and could not function at a normal level. He was 2 years behind his age group, so he was only in the 7th grade. Yet he did not know his multiplication tables, added on his fingers, and could barely read. There was one positive point. He loved to work on radio and TV sets. He wanted to become a TV technician. I encouraged this and pointed out that he needed math to qualify for the training. I decided to help him become proficient in this subject. We obtained 4 sets of flashcards: multiplication, division, addition, and subtraction. As we went through the cards, we put the correct answers in a discard stack. When David missed one, I gave him the correct answer and then put the card in the repeat stack until there were no more cards left. I made a big deal out of each card he got right, particularly if he had missed it previously. Each night, we would go through the repeat stack until there were no cards left. Each night, we timed the exercise with a stopwatch. I promised him that when he could get all the cards correct in 8 minutes with no incorrect answers, we would quit doing it every night. This seemed an impossible goal to David. The first night, it took 52 minutes. The second night, 48. Then 45, 44, 41, then under 40 minutes. We celebrated each reduction. I'd call in my wife and we would both hug him and we'd all dance a jig. At the end of the month, he was doing all the cards perfectly in less than 8 minutes. When he made a small improvement, he would ask to do it again. He had made the fantastic discovery that learning was easy and fun. Naturally, his grades in algebra took a jump. It is amazing how much easier algebra is when you can multiply. He astonished himself by bringing home a B in math. That had never happened before. Other changes came with almost unbelievable rapidity. His reading improved rapidly, and he began to use his natural talents in drawing. Later in the school year, his science teacher assigned him to develop an exhibit. He chose to develop a highly complex series of models to demonstrate the effect of levers. It required skill not only in drawing and model making, but in applied mathematics. The exhibit took first prize in his school's science fair and was entered in the city competition and won 3rd prize for the entire city of Cincinnati. That did it. Here was a kid who had flunked 2 grades, who had been told he was brain damaged, who had been called Frankenstein by his classmates, and told his brains must have leaked out of the cut on his head. Suddenly, he discovered he could really learn and accomplish things. The result? From the last quarter of the 8th grade all the way through high school, he never failed to make the honor roll. In high school, he was elected to the National Honor Society. Once he found learning was easy, His whole life changed. Tell someone that you have total faith in his ability to accomplish a goal and encourage him by highlighting all of the skills he possesses that will help him along the way, and he will practice until the dawn comes in the window in order to excel. Remember, abilities wither under criticism and blossom under encouragement. Magnify improvement, and you maximize others' talents. Chapter 7. Give others a fine reputation to live up to. Benjamin Zander was tired of watching his conservatory students, so anxious about the grading of their performances in his class, take a safe approach to their music education. In the top tiers of the arts world, bitter competition can define the talent development process. He considered abandoning grades altogether, but that presented a host of challenges, not the least of which was getting the head of the school to approve such a radical move. Instead, he decided he would give each student an A on the very first day of class. Upon meeting his new and nervous students, he would say, "Each student in this class will get an A for the course. However, there is one requirement that you must fulfill to earn this grade. Sometime during the next 2 weeks, you must write me a letter dated next May, and in this letter, you are to tell in as much detail as you can the story of what will have happened to you by next May that is in line with this extraordinary grade." He instructed the students to think of themselves in the future, looking back on all that they had done to earn such an illustrious grade. They were to discuss insights, milestones, and even competitions won. But Zander wanted more than a surface analysis. "I am especially interested in the person you will have become by next May. I am interested in the attitude, feelings, and world view of that person who will have done all she wished to do or become everything he wanted to be," he would say to them. What did he get from his students? Consider the following letter from a young trombonist. "Dear Mr. Z, today the world knows me. That drive of energy and intense emotion that you saw twisting and dormant inside me, yet alas, I could not show in performance or conversation, was freed tonight in a program of new music composed for me. The concert ended and no one stirred. A pregnant quiet, sighs, and then applause that drowned my heart's throbbing. I might have bowed, I cannot remember now. The clapping sustained such that I thought I might make my debut complete and celebrate the shedding of the mask and skin that I had constructed to hide within by improvising on my own melody as an encore unaccompanied. What followed is something of a blur. I forgot technique, pretension, tradition, schooling, history, truly even the audience. What came from my trombone, I wholly believe was my own voice. Laughter, smiles, a frown, weeping, Tucker Spirit did sing." Tucker Dulin. Over the 10 months of his course, Zander watched his students transform themselves in astounding ways. He calls his approach giving an A. In his book, The Art of Possibility, co-authored with his wife Rosamond Stone Zander, he has this to say about its potential to foster greatness in an individual. "An A can be given to anyone in any walk of life, to a waitress, to your employer, to your mother-in-law, to the members of the opposite team, and to the other drivers in traffic. When you give an A, you find yourself speaking to people not from a place of measuring how they stack up against your standards, but from a place of respect that gives them room to realize themselves. This A is not an expectation to live up to, but a possibility to live into." What a magical perspective to assume in an often cynical world. Coaches, mentors, leaders, and parents often find that people live up to our expectations of them, no matter how diminished those expectations are. If a man feels unimportant or disrespected, he will have little motivation for improving himself. So why not create a vision of him that embodies everything you know he is capable of achieving as well as everything you don't know about his possibilities. You will rarely be disappointed. Paige Ann Michelle McCabe's mother described her own adventures in creating a big girl reputation for her daughter. 4-year-old Paige Ann Michelle McCabe was sitting on one of our kitchen stools when she heard me tell her 6-year-old brother Brandon that it is now his responsibility to set the table each night before dinner. Paige looked hopeful and almost teary. "What am I big enough to do now, Mummy? What can I do, 'cause I'm big too?" Not wanting to break her little heart or deflate her ego, I searched quickly for something that she could take responsibility for. An idea crept into my head just in time. "Paige Ann Michelle," I announced triumphantly, "now that you are 4 years old and old enough to make proper choices, you are responsible for choosing your clothes for the next day. Each night before you take a bath, you should get your clothes out of your drawer and put them on the bed ready to wear in the morning when you wake up." The house was a flurry of activity. Brandon was zooming around setting the table, and Paige ran straight to her room where I could hear drawers and cupboards hurriedly opening and closing. About 10 seconds later, she ran out to report her success. "Look, Mummy, I did it. I got them out. Come and see. Come and see." Sure enough, the clothes were laid out on the bed ready to go. I told her how proud I was, now that she was growing up and had her very own job to do, and she beamed. The next morning, a miracle occurred in the McCabe house. Usually, Mummy has to coax a grumpy Paige out of bed, and getting her dressed is difficult, to say the least. If I choose a blue skirt, she wants to wear red pants. If I choose a white shirt with butterflies, she wants to wear the purple shirt with flowers on it. Finally, when I give in and tell her to choose, she takes forever. Paige stays grumpy, and I end up frustrated. But not that morning. "Look what I am wearing, Mummy," she said. She had got herself dressed before I had asked her to. I kissed her proudly and told her how happy I was with her choices. It was morning, and Paige Ann Michelle McCabe was happy. What a difference that made. Paige Ann Michelle McCabe had lived up to the fine reputation of a grown-up 4-year-old that had been bestowed upon her. To change somebody's behavior, change the level of respect she receives by giving her a fine reputation to live up to. Act as though the trait you are trying to influence is already one of the person's outstanding characteristics. Chapter 8. Stay connected on common ground. The employees of a manufacturing company had been on strike for 6 months when a labor contract was finally agreed upon. The terms, however, were less than what the employees had originally asked for. While the employees did return to work, tensions were running high on both sides. The working environment was toxic. How could they get past the animosity and move forward? In Crucial Conversations, authors Kerry Patterson, Joseph Grenny, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzer described how they worked with the two groups to build bridges. They instructed each group to spend time considering their goals for the company and to write them out on poster-sized paper. Each group spent 2 hours discussing their goals, then wrote the goals on the paper and posted it on the wall in the room they were in. The coaches then asked the teams to switch rooms and to review the other group's goals with the purpose of finding at least some morsel of common ground. What do you think happened? When the two groups returned to the meeting room, they were amazed. Their goals were almost identical. A profitable company, stable and rewarding jobs, high-quality products, and a positive impact on the community. While this revelation didn't erase the past, it provided each group with a new perspective on the other. They learned something about each other that would make it easier to reach more positive outcomes in the future. Why is common ground so important? For a leader to effectively influence another's attitude or behavior, he needs to overcome any potential resistance by making the person feel glad to do what is being asked. We aren't talking about manipulation or mind control here. If you consider what the other's goals are and how to connect your goals to hers, you will create a win-win situation that will make everybody glad. It is amazing how simple it is today to find a connection with another when we take the time to. If you go on an interview or a sales call, wouldn't you spend some time researching the company, discovering its vision, its stated goals, its values? All of this is information that many companies post front and center on their websites. And many go much further, posting employee bios, press releases, and updated information on their blogs. Yet we often don't take the time to make these same inroads with those in our lives, those standing right in front of us, even though it is just as easy. Ask people what they did over the weekend, what they hope to do for their next vacation, or what books they've recently read, and you'll discover something compelling and revealing about their goals, their dreams. And if you're connected with them online, it may be even easier. 6 Degrees to Kevin Bacon is an interesting pop culture phenomenon, but it's actually a fantastic way to think about those you want to influence. When you expand the translation to include common interests, common experiences, common goals, the truth is that we are only 1 degree away from anyone. To be influential with others, to make them happy to do what it is we would like them to do, we simply have to find that 1 degree that connects us. One student of the Dale Carnegie Training Institute in Germany discovered that taking the bold path of simply writing to those people she wanted to learn more about to possibly find that 1 degree of connection produced wondrous results. As I was very shy, I decided to write emails to the people I was interested in. I researched and found the addresses of very famous and well-known people and started to ask them questions about their backgrounds, such as how they got started in their businesses and what was important to them personally. 2 weeks later, I received a 2-page letter from the German president, Johannes Rau, who answered my questions. 6 weeks later, I received another letter. It was a big envelope, and a book was enclosed that would answer my questions. It was sent to me by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. What did this person learn? If you make the effort, people, all people, even those who seem unapproachable, will tell you their stories, their motivations, and their goals. One night, Dana White, the president of the Ultimate Fighting Championship Sports League, accidentally tweeted his direct phone number to more than 1 million fans, who retweeted it to untold numbers of people. The fans began calling within minutes. A leader less focused on making his customers happy would have called the phone company and had his number changed immediately. But that is not what Dana did. For more than an hour and a half, he took the calls that came in and talked to the fans. They loved it. It was a fortunate mistake, and Dana White learned a lot from it. He learned that talking to fans was valuable, and the PR company that helps manage UFC's online presence learned that they had a new opportunity to provide value to fans when, where, and how they want to receive it. Now Dana White has a dedicated line that he uses to take calls from fans. It's posted on all of his social media outlets. When he has time, he lets them know he's ready to talk, and the phone starts ringing. His accidental 90 minutes on the phone with UFC fans from all over the world was no gimmick, and that is key to Ultimate Fighting being the fastest-growing sport in the world, according to Mashable's Greg Ferenstein. White has been passionate about connecting with fans through social media from the start and relied on the grassroots support of his fans when major media refused to cover UFC events. When he hired Digital Royalty to grow UFC's online presence and train the fighters in social media techniques, he told the fighters, "I want you to tweet your asses off." The secret of his success in connecting with his fans? He is brutally honest and frank. To prove the power of this connection to a companion, White left a restaurant and walked to a nearby gas station at 11:30 at night. He tweeted his location. Within 3 minutes, there were about 100 fans there. In his analysis of Dana White's efforts, Greg Ferenstein wrote, "Transparency, outreach, and openness are now more important than ever as social media allows fans to subvert traditional channels and voice their opinions directly. White is willing to meet them halfway, forgoing false showmanship in order to genuinely connect with fans. While social media is a great tool for learning what drives somebody, it is only a tool. What leaders need to foster within themselves is a genuine desire to ascertain the answer and then to act on the information, a desire that many failed executives undermine, both knowingly and unknowingly. Of this depreciated desire among many high-powered executives, derailed author Dr. Tim Irwin concludes, "Just as humility seems to be at the epicenter of leadership effectiveness, arrogance is commonly at the root of a leader's undoing, and ours. Arrogance takes many forms. The most rudimentary is the self-centered focus that fosters a belief that I am central to the viability of the organization, the department, or the team. The resulting dismissiveness of others' contributions is inevitable. When arrogance blossoms into hubris, a sense of entitlement results. This place can't function without me, and I deserve special perks." Arrogant leaders also seem to eschew feedback so beneficial to any leader. They become truth-starved. A contrasting approach is found in Yvon Chouinard, co-founder, with his wife Melinda, of Patagonia, and author of Let My People Go Surfing. Yvon is proud of the fact that Patagonia hires the intensely independent, people who would be considered unemployable in a typical company, he's been told by organizational consultants. While he revels in his independent-minded employees, it also presents a management challenge: how to build a collaborative unit all focused on the same goals. One tool he uses is the design of the offices. "No one has a private office in our company, and everyone works in open rooms with no doors or separations, including Yvon and Melinda. What we lose in quiet thinking space is more than made up for with better communication and an egalitarian atmosphere." Now take it a step further and consider Admiral Janitorial Services, the fictional company described in Matthew Kelly's The Dream Manager. Turnover is high and costly, not surprising for a company staffed by transient workers. What to do? First, find out their biggest struggle. The company assumes that the biggest cause of turnover is pay, but when it surveys the employees, it discovers that their biggest struggle is transportation. Many rely on public transportation, which is spotty and even dangerous at night. What should the leaders of the company do? They provide shuttle service. It's costly, but what they save in turnover costs more than makes up for it. Employees stay twice as long, sick days have dropped, and morale is higher. Still, the leaders know they could do better. What really makes people leave, they wonder. The jobs are dead-end ones, not dream-fulfilling positions, and everybody knows it. The leaders decide that they can't fix that, but they can find ways to help employees move closer to their dreams while they work for Admiral. So they ask the employees, "What are your dreams?" Surprisingly, or maybe not, the employees tell them. Now the company has powerful information, and it uses it to help the employees achieve their dreams. One employee wants to learn Spanish. Another, who happens to be a Spanish speaker, wants to teach. So the company connects them. Yes, this story is fictional, but does the example seem extreme? Why shouldn't we know what our colleagues, co-workers, friends, and family members dream? How powerful that information would be. How central that information would be for sustaining a course whereby you and those in your sphere of influence achieve what is desired. Do you know what motivates the people around you? There are simple ways to find out. And once you have the information, it is a simple process to link your desired outcomes with their goals. 1. Be sincere. Do not promise anything that you cannot deliver. 2. Be empathetic. Ask yourself what it is the other person really wants. 3. Consider the benefits the person will receive from doing what you suggest. 4. Match those benefits to the other person's wants. 5. When you make your request, put it in a form that will convey to the other person the idea that he personally will benefit. The more you know of